Esther chapter 9 and 10. This will actually be our last study in the book of Esther, except we will do a recap or a review of some key points or key lessons that we have learned in the book of Esther this Thursday at 9 a.m. But this one will be titled, Should Jews Celebrate the Killing of 75,000 on Purim? You know, Jesus says that we are to love our enemies. But Jews who celebrate this holiday they call Purim mock and burn effigies of their enemies while commemorating the bloody revolution led by Esther and Mordecai that included the killing of many innocent women and children. And so the question I want to ask us is this. Is this really what God wants his chosen people to be doing? Does he really want us to celebrate a man-made holiday called Purim where this is done? And we're also going to ask ourselves this question as we get into this. Is it a coincidence that the murderous communist revolution of 1917 and the 2026 Iran war began precisely on this day called Purim? Is that a coincidence? Or is it all part of somebody's plan? Let's get into this. Breakdown, Esther 9 and 10 breakdown, verses 1 through 4, fear of the Jews strikes. Verses 5 through 11, 500 political leaders are assassinated in the palace in Shushan. Verses 12 through 14, we see Esther's merciless treatment of others. And in verses 15 through 16, the killing spree continues, led by Esther and Mordecai. And in verses 17 through 32, we see the Purim, communist revolution, and Iran war connection. And then in chapter 10, which is very short, just three verses, we see Mordecai's greatness proclaimed. All right, let's get into it. Verse 1. Now in the 12th month, that is the month Adar, on the 13th day of the same, 13 meaning rebellion, death, okay, rebellion or sometimes death, when the king's commandment and his decree drew near to put in execution, in the day that the enemies of the Jews hoped to have power over them, though it was turned to the contrary, that the Jews had rule over them that hated them. Okay, the book of Esther, like we said, is all about inversions, reversals. And it makes a good story. It makes a good story when you have those things, just like any good fiction writer or anybody that would write some plot to a movie, you always got to have these reversals, all these exciting things. And of course, we know that the book of Esther is historical fiction. Okay, it is the playbook of the synagogue of Satan. Verse 2, the Jews gathered themselves together in their cities throughout all the provinces of the king Ahasuerus to lay hand on such as sought their hurt, and no man could withstand them, for the fear of them fell upon all people. What are we talking about here? We're not talking about the fear of God falling on all the people and everybody converting to the worship of the true God. No, that's not what we're seeing here in this book. We're seeing great fear of the Jews spread across the land. Now, I might ask you this question. Why can you not criticize the nation of Israel today, the modern state of Israel's? We'll get into whether that they're actually Israelites or not at a later point. But why can you not criticize the Israeli nation? Why is it that a certain group of people disproportionately are disproportionately represented in various places in government and in various institutions and in the ownership of things like pornography, Hollywood productions, music productions, why can't you say that? Why can't you point those things out? Because there's this great fear that you will be labeled an anti-Semite. There's this great fear that you will be attacked so viciously that you will be ostracized from society. Is there anything, I might ask, is there anything new under the sun? Okay, this was a long time ago, right? This was before the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, that they were able to, that this deep state was able to orchestrate this great fear of a small minority of people who always seem to end up in power. Now, we're not talking about our true brother Judah. We're talking about the synagogue of Satan, those of Revelation, those who claim they are Jews but are not. They say they are of Judah. They say they are of the chosen bloodline, but they're imposters, Jesus says in the book of Revelation. All right, so they gather themselves together, the synagogue of Satan, the false Jews, gather themselves together to lay hands on anybody that they feel is a threat to them. Now, I will ask you this question. What's the greatest threat to the synagogue of Satan? Well, the true church. Christians are. Okay? The many-member body of Christ. Do you see the great parable of the book of Esther? It's really all about Christian persecution. Led by Esther and Mordecai, Esther being Mystery Babylon, the great of Revelation chapter 17 and 19, which Esther means, her very name means Ishtar, the queen of Babylon. Mordecai means worshiper of Marduk, the chief political god of Babylon, the god that was known as the kingmaker, the great kingmaker. Verse 3, and all the rulers of the provinces and the lieutenants and the deputies and the officers of the king helped the Jews. Why? Because the fear of Mordecai fell upon them. Okay, so now we have an instance where all of the world leaders are helping these people that are claiming to be Jews. Okay, although Mordecai was not of the true tribe of Judah. He was a Babylonian god, and so was Esther, basically wrapped in Hebrew flesh to deceive the true tribe of Judah, okay? So they gather together, but why, I might ask you this question, why are the leaders of the world helping these people claiming to be Jews, claiming to be God's chosen people? Why? Because the fear of Mordecai, the fear of Marduk, the Babylonian god, fell upon them. Now, who was Mordecai in this book of Esther? He was the deep state agent. He was that guy that kind of sat in the king's gate, sat behind the scenes and watched and had intelligence of everything. You could think of him as like an Israeli Mossad agent, if you would, or somebody above all of the intelligence services of the earth, okay? He was the guy. And so political leaders, all of our political leaders, fear the deep state. They know there's this hidden power within our government, within governments around the world, that can attack them if they do not lend a helping hand to them. And so they play the game. And there's some that are not doing this, right? The guy that just got voted out, Thomas Massie, because of Israeli money or Zionist money. He's actually really putting up a good fight against the Zionist movement or the synagogue of Satan. And he's holding something in Congress where he's commemorating or honoring the servicemen and women, I don't know if there was women on there or not, but servicemen that were on the USS Liberty that was purposely, many believe, bombed for hours by the Israeli nation. You can look it up on Wikipedia even, and you can find out that the nation of Israel bombed for hours one of our ships on the sea. And he's going to commemorate that group. Verse 4, for Mordecai was great in the king's house, and his fame went throughout all the provinces. For this man, Mordecai, waxed greater and greater. Okay, historically, you could think of characters like Henry Kissinger. Today, it seems like it's Mark Levin. That seems to be the guy that President Trump always tells us to watch. You know, hey, go watch Levin tonight. There's a message that I'm relaying to him, to you guys, about something. And there are others. There are others in many other Mordecai-type figures within the Trump administration. And they've been in not just Trump's administration, but every other president for a long time, at least since the assassination of JFK. Verse 5, thus the Jews smote all their enemies with the stroke of the sword, and with slaughter and destruction, and did what they would unto those that hated them. You might think of Gaza. That was a time. Is there an issue over there, Lucy? Nope. Okay. I thought maybe we were having an issue with our stream. You might think of Gaza and how that the Israeli nation committed genocide there. They did what they would unto those that hated them. How are they able to do what they want to do to anybody who hated them or who they hate, vice versa? How can they do that? Well, they have the help of King Ahasuerus here. Historically, who do they have the help of today? The American government, the American president, and not just Trump, but other American presidents. Verse 6, and in Shushan, the palace, the Jews slew and destroyed 500 men. All right, now where does this start? Where does the killing spree start? It starts in the palace. Where? On this Purim killing spree. It doesn't just start with 75,000. It starts in the palace with 500 men. This is a political purging, my friends. If you want to know what they plan to do tomorrow and the next day and the next day after that, like I said, the book of Esther is their playbook. It is the playbook or the blueprint of how the synagogue of Satan operates. How do I know that? Because the synagogue of Satan is based on Babylonian mystery religions, the religions that include the worship of gods and goddesses like Esther and Mordecai, Ishtar and Marduk. So the purging starts with the political figures. And hey, they went, is it a coincidence that a major political figure, he didn't hold public office, but had held great sway in politics, Charlie Kirk, was just recently assassinated. Now, one other figure that has been going against the Israel First movement, or the truth that Israel has way too much control over our government, Representative Thomas Massey. Okay, the Zionists came and intervened in that local election of Kentucky, spent millions of dollars to get a pro-Zionist candidate in office. What's going on here? They're trying to start a purge, my friends. And I feel like we're at the very beginning of this. All right, verse 7. And Parshandatha and Delphon and Aspatha and Paratha and Adalia and Aridatha and Parmashta and Arishia and, oh, I already read that, I think. Oh, no, I didn't. And Aredia and Vajethzatha. Okay, hard to pronounce names. The 10 sons of Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews, slew they, but on the spoil they laid not their hand. Now, I want you to see something here. We're going to talk about who the 10 sons of Haman represent, who they may represent. But let's talk about this first. On the spoil they laid not their hand. We talked about in the beginning that the communist revolution of 1917 started on Purim. It started on Purim. And what did the communists always claim? What was their big claim to fame? Okay. Their big claim to fame is that, oh, we want to take power away from the wealthy Christian leaders that had ruled in Europe. We want to take power away from them and we want to just give it to the little people. Okay. We want to redistribute wealth. So here we see this hidden claim in the book of Esther. Part of their scheme is that they would say, oh, this is not about, we're doing this for the sake of righteousness. We're not doing this for the sake of stealing anybody's wealth. Well, we know that's really a lie, right? But who are these 10 sons of Haman? Well, we talk about the 10, this is a parable. This book is a parable. The whole thing is, okay, on how the synagogue of Satan operates. The one thing that they do not want you to know, the one thing they want to kill, is the idea, the identity of the 10 lost tribes of Israel. Why do they want to kill that? Because if people find out who the 10 tribes of Israel are, that they are those who crossed north over the Caucasus Mountains after the Assyrian captivities, later went into Europe, converted to Christianity when the gospel came, and they became the Christian nations of the world, and then later, obviously, came to America. When they find out that the Caucasians, if people were to find out that the white Caucasians were actually the true descendants of Israel, then they would begin to look over at the modern state of Israel and say, hey, you know what? You know, the book of Hosea and other prophecies all throughout the Bible point to the white Christian nations as being the Israelites. But who are these people claiming to be of the tribe of Judah? But they can't document their lineage. Many of them are of Ashkenazi descent. The great majority of the Jews today, especially in Israel, are of Ashkenazi descent who never were of the tribe of Judah at all. They originated in southern Russia, southern Europe. And there's a whole story behind that. There's even a book called The 13th Tribe, written by somebody of Ashkenazi Jewish descent who says, hey, we're not even of Judah at all. And we don't have time to get into that today. But they want to kill that message. In fact, if there's one message that's hated above all, it is the fact that the white Christian nations are the Israelites. You can call it Christian Israel. You can call it whatever you want. Because it not only does it expose who the false children of Judah are and the modern state of Israel and the false regathering, but it also unifies the biblical themes that that both the dispensationalists and the replacement, those who hold on to the replacement belief that the church replaced Israel, it solves the mystery of both of them. Because the dispensationalists know that there are promises that were given to Israel that have not been done away with because they were unconditional. And so they know that, okay? The dispensationalists know that. But the replacement theologians know that there's no way that this regathering of 1948 is fulfilling biblical prophecy because it's not a movement built on the foundation of the gospel of Jesus Christ. So these two forces go back and forth fighting each other, and they both present valid biblical points. But the one key that unlocks it all is that the 10 tribes of Israel were never done away with. God divorced them, yes. In the book of Hosea, he gives them a letter of divorcement. He says, you're going to be called not my people. You're going to be called Gentiles for a long time. And then later, you're going to be called my people again when you reawaken to who you are when Jesus Christ returns, at the time that Ezekiel talks about when the dry bones come to life because the Holy Spirit comes upon them, and the message of who they are hits the world. And I think that's coming. I think that's coming. Verse 11. So I'll just go back to this really quick. The 10 sons of Haman, I have no doubt, represent the 10 lost tribes of Israel. And other people even say that it might even represent the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments that the synagogue of Satan tries to destroy worldwide. Verse 11. On that day, the number of those that were slain in Shushan the palace was brought before the king. Thus the Jews smote all their enemies with the stroke of the sword and with slaughter and destruction, and did what they would unto those that hated them. Man, does this, if you're reading this as a Christian, I know there are some books like when the Israelites went in and conquered the land of Canaan, that they were, it was, you know, it was war. It was total war. But this is different. When people read this, they know this is different because there's a lot of malice in here. There's a lot of when the Israelites went into Canaan, it was all about advancing the kingdom of God, not the greatness of Mordecai, Esther, these Babylonian gods who have deceived the Hebrews, okay, into thinking that they represent them and all this kind of stuff, right? But so there is this celebration. There is this, in other words, when the Israelites conquered the land of Canaan, there wasn't this idea that we're celebrating death and destruction. Okay. It was more somber. It was more the judgment of God was falling upon the Canaanites because of their abominations, because of the things that they did there. And God used the Israelites as his battle axe and weapons of war. But never did they have these grotesque celebrations that we're going to talk a little bit more about called Purim. Where you glorify death, you glorify revenge, you glorify the reversal, you just shove it in everybody's face. That's what Purim is. It's the opposite. It's the opposite of what the gospel teaches us to do. And that's why people like Martin Luther and other early Christians, that's why they recognize that there was something wrong with this book. It doesn't seem to line up with the rest of the Bible. All right, verse 6, and in Shushan, the palace, the Jews slew and destroyed 500 men. Did we already read that?
Yeah, I think it's 6. We were just on 11.
Okay, we somehow got backwards. All right. I must have doubled up on the slides. We're on 12. Okay. I must have somehow. Okay, well, we'll go to this. Interestingly, did I read verse 12? Or are we on 12? Okay, I must have skipped 12 somehow. Let's go back and see if I have it. Nope, I skipped it. Okay, well, I don't have it.
It's probably after these, right?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to go onto the slide really quick here. You know, it's interesting. We're talking about Purim, and I talked about how the communist revolution began on Purim. Huge, okay? And hear me out on this. Tsar Nicholas II and his family were shot and stabbed to death by Bolshevik revolutionaries in July 1918. Okay, so the former ruler of Russia, who was a Christian, was murdered in the night along with his wife and kids and other workers. And some say it est that this family, that the number could have been 10 or 11 people that were killed on this night. Now think Haman's 10 sons again. Why do we keep seeing this parallel? And remember, the Purim starts with the purging of the people in the palace. It starts with the purging of the politicians. How did the communist revolution start? The Red Terror. It started with the murder of the Christian czars. And next, after that, it was all of the politicians and the church leaders that we're going to talk about. And I'm going to read this. We can pull this up on the screen for everybody. The Bolshevik persecution of Russian Orthodox Christians. The Bolsheviks and later Soviets launched a fierce anti-religious campaign viewing the Orthodox Church as tied to the Tsarist regime and an opiate of the people. This was systematic atheist repression, not a single event targeting exactly 10 leaders. But key facts, early phase of the communist Bolshevik revolution, 1917 to 1922, was called the Red Terror, where dozens of bishops and thousands of priests, monastics, were executed. Estimates, 28 bishops plus 1,200 or 1,200 plus priests in the first 5 years alone. Broader 1917 to 1935 figures reach 95,000 priests executed out of 130,000 arrested. Now check this out. So we got 28 bishops and 1,200 priests were murdered by the Bolsheviks, who were represented disproportionately as people who claimed to be of the tribe of Judah. They supposedly, good evidence supports that the synagogue of Satan was behind the Bolshevik revolution. But methods were often brutal and public degrading, paralleling hanging as humiliation, crucifixion on church doors. These religious leaders were burned alive, drowned, scalped, boiled, thrown down mine shafts, paraded, and beaten. Examples include the Bishop Tikhon of Voronezh was crucified. Another bishop here, Adranek of Perim, burned alive. Bishop Hermogenes of Tobolsk tied to a paddle wheel and drowned. And another guy Vladimir of Kiev, was strangled with his own cross chain. Many others in the new martyrs canonized by the Russian church. And on the list goes, you can come back to me now. So what do we see here? What was the communist revolution? Who led it? What was led by those who hated Christians? Who are those that hate Christians? The synagogue of Satan. What are we ultimately talking about here? Who are these imposters of the synagogue of Satan? They are those of the serpent seed of Genesis chapter 3, verse 15. This isn't something that is unconnected. The communist revolution began on Purim because Purim is the holiday celebrated by the serpent seed. And that is the day in which they like to launch their attacks. And it makes me wonder, because we know the first serpent seed, the first child of the devil, was Cain, okay, who killed Abel. It makes me wonder, and I wouldn't be surprised if I later find this out, and I'm digging into it. I'm trying to find a connection here. I wouldn't be surprised if Purim, this Adar 14, if this was the same day that Cain killed Abel, that Cain took revenge upon Abel, that Cain tried to, you know, in his jealousy and his hatred, because Abel's sacrifice was acceptable. Abel was a type of Christians, right? Cain is a type of the synagogue of Satan. But there's this bloodline feud between the true seed of the woman in Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, and the seed of the serpent, or the seed of Satan. And it's been going on since the beginning. A lot of people wonder, well, it's this group, it's the Illuminati, it's the socialists, it's this group, it's they go by a lot of different names, okay? But the one theme you see is that there's all they follow the same holidays, they follow the same patterns, they follow the same playbooks, and it all goes back to the same battle that God told us has been waging since the book of Genesis. It is the false line of the serpent who claimed to be the chosen people of God, and serpent claims to be the true Messiah. All the way to Revelation chapter 12, where you see the same battle taking place. The dragon, or the serpent, trying to destroy the remnant of the woman seed, who are what? Christians. Not only Christians, but they're Christians who hold on to the commandments of God. And that's, you know, something that doesn't happen very often these days. There's a lot of people, there are a lot of churches out there that say, well, we don't believe in biblical morality anymore. You just do it. It's just natural. No, you still have to study it. You're not, we'll go into that another time. I don't want to get down a rabbit trail on the law versus grace and the law and grace and all those types of discussions, okay? Anyways, I'm going to go over this. I guess we'll look at this slide. We'll kind of sum up what I've been saying, at least give you something to look at. I'll also put this chart, more than likely, and I have this chart along with many other charts on our website, on our landing page for this book of Esther, where we have all of our studies archived, all of many different PDFs that you can download, and this will probably be one of them. So check it out. There's a link in our video description on YouTube and Rumble if you're watching us there to that page. All right, Purim, historical and modern parallels. 1917 February Revolution ignited on Purim. Okay, it actually happened in March, but the Russians used the Julian calendar instead of the Gregorian. So if you research this, you might wonder, why is it called the February Revolution instead of the March Revolution? It's because the Russians went by the Julian calendar, not the Gregorian, as most of the world did at that time. But do the research. You'll see it's exactly, this all happened exactly on Purim. But I want you to see something. The 1917 February Revolution ignited on Purim, which later this day was called the International Women's Day. And that led to the deposition of, or the overthrow of, the Tsarist Christian order. Now you can come back to me, Lucy. What was the thing that ignited the communist revolution on Purim? This is fascinating. This is very interesting. Well, there was this big women's protest going on. It was there was this women's protest in Russia that ignited the communist revolution. And we're not going to go into all the details on it. I just want you to know that. Why do I want you to know that? Well, what was Esther? What does she represent? Well, she was a woman, right? There's nothing against godly women and treating women good. Treat women and husbands, treat your wives like Christ treated the church. This is something different. Okay? Esther is kind of known as a feminist figure, as a leader of modern feminism. Is that by accident? That Purim, the day that Esther commemorates, is later called International Women's Day, and it's also, and it was also the actual day that the communist revolution was fomented by a riot led by women. Is that a coincidence? No, because this all starts with Esther, Mystery Babylon, the great harlot of the earth, and that the arch enemy of humanity, of the church and humanity, written about in Revelation chapter 17 and 18. And it was basically what we saw with the communist revolution in Russia, was that it overthrew the Christian leaders. Now, the Christian leaders obviously probably weren't perfect, and these revolutionaries found their imperfections and ignited the hatred of the people to go against their own Christian leaders because of perceived wrongs and all these types of things, right? And that's how things happen. Well, this is the same thing that's going on today in America. We're having cultural Marxism is taking over America. Okay, and why? What's its purpose? To destroy Christianity. And I'll go even further than that. To destroy white. Okay? To destroy not only Christianity, but white people along with Christianity. Why white people? Is it because they're white? No. It's because they represent the 10 lost tribes of Israel, and they know it. They are the remnant of the woman seed of Revelation chapter 12, so that the dragon wants to destroy. So there's two things that you, if you want to understand prophecy, all you got to do is say, hey, what are the two things the world hates the most right now? White people, especially white men, and Christianity. And then the next question you got to ask yourself is why? Where did this hatred start from? Well, the Bible has the answer to all those questions. But the modern Zionist movement would have us believe that, oh no. It's anti-Semitism that we need to be afraid of. That's what's going on here. And they've inverted the truth, right? When it's actually the pro-Zionist forces are the ones that are behind communism. They were the ones behind Purim. They're the ones behind communism. They're the ones behind the overthrow of Christian orders in Europe. And they're the forces behind leading Christian persecution worldwide. All right, let's go back to this chart. Okay, next point. Bolshevik consolidation, Esther 8 through 10 pattern. Well, how they do this is there's this power transfer, much like we see in the book of Esther and Mordecai, counter decrees and anti-Semitism laws, mass purge of Christian clergy and leaders. Now, after the communist revolution, what do you think they passed right away after they murdered all these Christian leaders? Anti-Semitism laws go hand in hand. First, purge the Christians. Pass anti-Semitism laws, or do both at the same time. All right, next point. Haman's 10 sons, typological link to executed Russian Christian leaders, clergy under the Red Terror. In other words, you see there's a type between Haman's 10 sons and the leaders, the Christian leaders being executed under the Red Terror. Now, here's something interesting. In 2026, the U.S. Israel strikes on Iran, major military operations and regional conflict overlapping Purim 2026, February 28th through March 26th window. Widely framed, and people say that the attack actually began on Purim, widely framed in Israeli media and commentary as a modern Purim story with Persia, Iran as the ancient enemy. And then you even had Franklin Graham making a prayer on Resurrection Sunday, basically in Esther's name, in support of the nation of Israel and the destruction of Iran. All right. In World War II, we had something called the Nuremberg Trials in 1946, where interestingly, exactly 10 Nazis were hanged, and one of them that was being hanged yelled out, screamed out, Purim Fest 1946 before dying. All right. What makes this all very, very interesting here is this. Purim falls on the same day in Babylonian mythology or Babylonian religion as what's called Marduk's Day. Okay. Babylonian, okay, is same as Adar 14. Babylonian observance tied to the other god Marduk, kingmaker, creator, reversal. All right, we can come back to me. So what that really seals it up for me is that Purim wasn't originated, you know, around, you know, just several couple hundred years before Christ came, okay? Several hundred years before Christ came with Esther and Mordecai supposedly as, you know, these leaders of the Jews, because it didn't originate there. It originated long ago in Babylonian, and that's befitting. It has to, right? If Esther and Mordecai are Babylonian gods, well, the holiday Purim has got to have Babylonian links. The very name of Purim means to divine, to perform some kind of a witchcraft ceremony to determine what's coming in the future. Okay. So this day, Purim, is celebrated on the same day that the Babylonians celebrated Marduk. It was called Marduk's Day. Now, what's interesting, we brought up in an earlier study, I think in Esther chapter 2 or 3, when Esther was crowned queen, that was the day that the Babylonians celebrated Ishtar by observing, I think it was the planet Venus rising in the winter sky, becoming, you know, getting to her highest elevated spot, the planet Venus, getting to its highest point of elevation to where they said that represents the crowning of Ishtar. Happened on all these. How could we say this is a biblical book? How can we say that this has, how could any Christian support the story of Esther and Mordecai when it's clearly a Babylonian religion dressed up as a Jewish religion and inserted into the Bible, inserted into the holy place? All right, how could they do that? All right, verse 12. And the king said unto Esther, the queen. Oh, we do have verse 12. All right, you were right. And the king said unto Esther, the queen, the Jews have slain and destroyed 500 men in Shushan the palace and the 10 sons of Haman. What have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now, what is thy petition? And it shall be granted thee. Or what is thy request further? And it shall be done. Man, look at this king here. You can come back to me. You were fascinated reading the scripture there, weren't you? Here we see this request again, the king, this bumbling king, right? Hey, Esther, you guys are already, you know, you purged a bunch of those, I'll just update it to what it's really like, those Christian leaders, right? You killed a bunch of those Christian leaders. What do you want now? I'll give you permission to kill some more if you want. I'll give you half of the kingdom. I think this was like the third or fourth time that the king just tells Esther she can have whatever she wants, up to the half of the kingdom. Free reign. Again, do we not see that parallel in America today? Our politicians, our president, President Trump, and our politicians just giving what they believe are the Jews, giving the Jews free reign to attack their enemy. We give them military might. We give them weaponry. We give them permission. We just, hey, just go do whatever you want to do. Wow. All right, verse 13. Then said Esther, if it please the king, let it be granted to the Jews which are in Shushan to do tomorrow also according unto this day's decree. And let Haman's 10 sons be hanged upon the gallows. All right. So it wasn't enough. You know, not it, they didn't get enough killing in, right? So she says, yeah, if it pleased the king, can we please kill some more people? We enjoy this, it seems like she's saying, right? We really enjoy this. All right, so I want you to see something here. Haman's 10 sons were already killed. They were already killed. But that wasn't enough for Esther, this beauty queen, beauty pageant winner that Christians are enamored with. And, oh, the hero, Esther, who saved her people. We got all these children's stories and we present her as this wonderful woman, but we never get into her dark side, do we? We never get into the fact that Esther wanted to hang 10 of Haman. We don't even know how young they were. Some of these sons, it wasn't a real story, but we know that the Romanovs had some young children. But, you know, so it probably doesn't even matter to them if these are 2-year-olds, 4-year-olds. Just kill them. And now it's not enough. We got to hang them up for everybody to see. Is that not malice? Is that not what we consider wickedness? This beautiful Queen Esther, who's supposed to be everybody's hero, who's never mentioned by anybody else in the Bible. She's not in the Heroes of Faith chapter of Hebrews 11. You'd think she would be, because the book Hebrews is written for the Hebrews. And if she was some Jewish hero, the greatest Jewish hero of all times, surely she would have been in the book of Hebrews. But I don't think the Christian leaders didn't acknowledge her, okay? Because they knew what she was, a Babylonian goddess. All right. So there also, I want you to know that there is a law in the book of Deuteronomy, and I can't remember the exact verse now. There is a law, and you could look this up, that God prohibits bodies. If you had to give somebody the death penalty, and there was the death penalty, there was stoning, there was hanging, you know, there was capital punishment in the Old Testament. We're not saying there wasn't, and we're not against that. But there was a law where God didn't want death to be glorified or for this to become vile. When you execute somebody according to law, God didn't want it to turn into some bloodthirsty festival, bloodthirsty carnival like Purim. He said if you hang somebody, you should not let their body hang overnight. You have to take the bodies down before sunset and bury them. You have to do that. Otherwise, this turns into something sadistic, something satanic. And God, like Esther's doing here. So Esther, what am I saying? Esther is clearly violating the commandments or the law of God here. How could a hero clearly, especially a law like this, a law that protected the Israelites from becoming vile like their enemies were? Verse 14, and the king commanded it so to be done, and the decree was given at Shushan, and they hanged Haman's 10 sons. Verse 15, for the Jews that were in Shushan gathered themselves together on the 14th day of the month, Adar, and slew 300 men at Shushan, but on the prey they laid not their hands. Of course, good communists, you know, are for the people. Verse 16, but the other Jews that were in the king's provinces gathered themselves together and stood for their lives and had rest from their enemies and slew of their foes 75,000, but they laid not their hands on the prey. All right, here's where we have the mass purging happening here. We kill all the Christian leaders. We're just updating this to today because we know what this is about. The synagogue of Satan's plan is first kill Haman and his 10 sons, kill the most prominent Christian leaders, political and or religious, then kill the other political leaders. So we're just purging, we're just wiping, we're committing genocide of Christians here. Then go after all of the other Christians that resist our power. Okay? That is the name of the game. And this really isn't that much different than what you read in the Gospels of the persecution against the church by the synagogue of Satan. And it's really not different than what you see in the book of Acts as the church is persecuted by the synagogue of Satan. Verse 17, on the 13th day of the month Adar, and on the 14th day of the same rested they, and made it a day of feasting and gladness. 14 being the number of victory in the Bible, and the enemy seems to use that as well. A day of feasting and gladness. But verse 18, but the Jews that were at Shushan assembled together on the 13th day thereof, and on the 14th day thereof, and on the 15th day of the same, they rested and made it a day of feasting and gladness. Not a holiday commanded by God that you would find in the book of Leviticus, but instituted by Esther and Mordecai. Therefore, verse 19, therefore the Jews of the villages that dwelt in the unwalled towns made the 14th day of the month Adar a day of gladness and feasting. Remember, this is the day of Marduk and Babylonian paganism, worship, and a good day, and a day of sending portions to one another. All right, and you want to know something a little, they send gifts. This is part of the Purim celebration. When the two witnesses in the book of Revelation are killed, who are the arch enemies of these people, okay, when they're killed, what do we see them doing in that chapter? They start giving gifts one to another. They literally, I believe, when the two witnesses are killed in Revelation 11, the world celebrates Purim like they've never celebrated before. Let that sink in. Because you might think, oh, Purim's just a history. No, it's not. It's an ongoing thing. And it is the day that the Babylonian gods determine the destruction of God's true people. Verse 20, and Mordecai wrote these things and sent letters unto all the Jews that were in all the provinces of the king Ahasuerus, both nigh and far, to establish this among them, that they should keep the 14th day of the month Adar and the 15th day of the same yearly. You know, and I'm going to just comment on that. I pointed out some things, some major events that have happened on Purim, major world-changing events. There are also a lot of minor things and things we never see in the news media. So they do, they observe. I believe this is part of the synagogue of Satan's ritual, is they have to commit some kind of an attack on their enemies, some kind of a sacrifice, if you would, or a killing. Of some kind of a killing. Killing somebody either on a mass scale, a symbolic scale, a small scale, you name it. I don't think they go Purim without trying something. All right. To sum up what we've been talking about a little bit here. Besides celebrating the killing of 75,000 and burning effigies of their enemies, Jews who celebrate Purim get heavily intoxicated, participate in various debaucheries, a lot of deviant sexual acts and things like that, and do things like eat cookies in the shape of Haman's ears. Now think about this. You can come back to me now. Think about this. Is this a holiday that God wants us to celebrate? Is this what God's chosen people should be doing? Celebrating, mocking, celebrating, burning little dolls made of your enemies, and you know, and these celebrations are get loud. They get heavily intoxicated. They're stomping their feet. They're making loud claps, loud noises, and then they're eating cookies. made in the shape of Haman's ears. So kill your enemies and then consume your enemies? Is that really what Christians should be honoring? Is this really, and there are many people who celebrate this over in the modern state of Israel today. Do we really want this to be our greatest ally? You say, well, not everybody celebrates that. Well, why don't they come out against it? If Israel wants to be our greatest ally, they need to start calling out these things. Instead of calling everybody anti-Semitism for noticing these things, okay? If they truly loved righteousness, they truly loved what was right, they would say, hey, we can't be doing these things. These are not good. But that's not in the playbook. Okay, verse 23. And the Jews undertook to do as they had begun, and as Mordecai had written unto them. Verse 24, because Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, there they lay a blood libel on him, okay? The enemy of all the Jews had devised against the Jews to destroy them and had cast pur, that is, the lot, to consume them and to destroy them. But when Esther came before the king, he commanded by letters that his wicked device, you know, Haman, the great anti-Semite, which he had devised against the Jews, should return upon his own head, and that he and his sons should be hanged on the gallows. Wherefore, they called these days Purim after the name of Pur. Therefore, all the words of this letter and of that which they had seen concerning this matter and which had come unto them. Now, let's go back. Let's talk about something for a second. I wonder if Cain killed Abel with a stone. There are a lot of people that depict Cain killing Abel. They show Cain with some big stone. But did you know what that pur means, to cast lots or even to throw a stone? I feel like this day, why this day? Why is this day so important? You always got to go back to the prime root. Okay. It all goes back to the Garden of Eden, usually in one way or the other, or in Eden, or somewhere in the book of Genesis. Where did this holiday, because I mean, there's a lot of stuff that goes back to, a lot of typology goes back to Noah's flood, the dates. We're not going to go into that. But why this day of revenge? I feel like it has to be connected. I feel like this has to be, and I can't document this right now. I feel like this has to be the day that Cain killed Abel, that maybe the day that he threw a rock and bludgeoned his brother to death. And they commemorate this every day because Cain cannot get this out of his heart, that the other line, the woman's seed, that would ultimately be, Seth would have replaced Abel, would be the chosen line of God, the line that God approves of, and that his line wasn't. And that's what this is all about. Okay? And we see it play out with the synagogue of Satan today versus Christianity. Communism versus Christianity. Zionism versus Christianity. Socialism versus Christianity. LGBTQ versus Christianity. It's all coming from the same source. Same people. All right. Verse 27. The Jews ordained and took upon them and upon their seed. Oh, that's interesting. Seed line. Genesis 3:15. Not the true seed line, but the serpent seed line. And upon all such as joined themselves unto them. Oh, a lot of people joined the Christian Zionists. So as it should not fail that they should keep these 2 days according to their writing and according to the appointed time every year. You know, you got the Mike, you can come back to me. You got the Mike Huckabees, the Ted Cruzes, and all these guys that are, you know, that are joining in with this Purim celebration. Because it says all of the seed of the false seed they celebrate this day, and those that joined with them. And we see that there are many today that are doing the same thing, and they do it every year. Verse 28, and I'll mention this as well. Sorry. I mentioned this as well. How many of our presidents and political leaders go over, put on their little skull cap, you know, and then put their hand on the wall of the temple, which Christ is the temple now. Who cares about some physical wall? There's even some debate as to whether that wall even was the actual wall of the temple, and we won't go into that. But how many of our political leaders launch their campaigns going to... We see President Bush, we see Trump, we see all of these leaders going there with these rabbis, putting on a skull cap and making a prayer, putting their hand on the Western Wailing Wall in Jerusalem. That should make you think. That should make you wonder what's going on here. All right, verse 28. And these days should be remembered and kept throughout every generation, every family, every province, and every city, and that these days of Purim should not fail among the Jews, nor the memorial of them perish from their seed. Okay, they celebrate, Purim celebrates murder and revenge and hatred, but Resurrection Day, Passover and Resurrection Day commemorate the time that death was defeated. You see, total opposites. Purim is the total inversion of what we celebrate as Christians. Verse 29, then Esther the queen, the daughter of Abihail, and Mordecai the Jew wrote with all authority to confirm this second letter of Purim. And he sent the letters unto all the Jews to the 127 provinces of the kingdom of Ahasuerus with words of peace and truth to confirm these days of Purim in their times appointed, according as Mordecai the Jew and Esther the queen had enjoined them, and as they had decreed for themselves and for their seed the matters of fastings and their cry. And the decree, law of Esther, confirmed these matters of Purim, and it was written in the book. All right, Esther chapter 10, verse 1, we're just going to read, it's just three verses, and then we'll complete this study. And the king Ahasuerus laid a tribute upon the land and upon all the isles of the sea. So this is great. This is wonderful. We just had a Purim celebration. Now what happens next? A worldwide tax on the citizens. Okay. Sounds a lot like communism, right? Just, you know, the Bolsheviks gain power, Christians are destroyed, and now everybody suffers under heavy taxation and government oppression. Verse 2, and all the acts of his power and his might and the declaration of the greatness of Mordecai, Marduk, Babylonian God, whereunto the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of the Medes, Media, and Persia? All right, now think about what the king Ahasuerus did here in theory, okay? He's advancing the Babylonian religion, the religion of Cain, the religion that we read about that is the arch enemy of Christianity and the world, called Mystery Babylon in Revelation 17 and 18. That Mystery Babylon that is said to be covered in the blood of the saints and all that were slain upon the earth. Okay. And Mordecai is, you know, so they're proclaiming the greatness of Babylon when they're doing this. Verse 3, final verse. For Mordecai, the Jew, the fake Jew, was next unto King Ahasuerus and great among the Jews and accepted of the multitude of his brethren, seeking the wealth of his people and speaking peace to all his seed. Well, that's just what it's all about, right? Let's just advance the synagogue of Satan. Let's make them rich, prosperous, and powerful. And that's what this is all about. That's what Purim is all about. Get rid of the opposition. It's not about justice. It's not about a true Purim is not about some true reversal of, you know, getting the people who wanted to do something bad. It's all about, and always has been, about removing the obstacles to Satan's power, okay? Get rid of Christians, get rid of Christianity, get rid of the true Israelites, who we know they're white Caucasians today. Get rid of them all, and then we can have this glorious new world order, okay? Centered on, headquartered in Jerusalem with the false Messiah as their king. All right, with that said, we will, I'll read this quote and then we'll take questions and comments. Communism's war on Christianity was one of history's worst persecutions of faith. And remember, it all began on Purim. Questions and comments. Do we have any, Lucy?
Okay.
You'll see a light on the mic.
Okay. Hand of Seed says, any correlation to the 80s cartoon He-Man and Haman?
Wow. That's interesting. I don't know. I'll have to look into this. I'm telling you what, the more I dig into this, it's like we were 10 minutes late getting on broadcasting here today. Because I was just like, it's just like a domino effect. I'm finding out one thing, one connection leads to another, to another, to another. And I'm like, well, I want to get that in. I want to share that. I want to make sure everybody knows that. And that's one of the reasons we're going to do a recap of this book on Thursday at 9 a.m. We're going to do live on YouTube. And we're going to do a recap. And we're going to do this with every book that we do in the future. We're going to do recaps after we get done so that we can kind of catch up on what we might be able to share some things we missed in our regular studies, but also just consolidating our minds, you know, just concrete in our minds what these books are about. What were the key prophetic points? What were the key lessons? And not only are we making the videos on this, but we're making a landing page for each book of the Bible that we teach with all of our studies in there and all of our study helps. And we're just beginning this. We've got the book of Esther almost completed. We've got the book of Deuteronomy completed. And we're going to go through our archives and probably do the book of Deuteronomy, the book of Revelation, and so on and so forth, and get those done for you guys. All right. Any others?
Oh, yeah. Jeannie said, and did what they would with those who hated them. Wow, that is exactly what the IDF is doing to anyone and everyone they claim to be a threat.
Yeah, she's absolutely right. We're hearing this every day, right? We're hearing the atrocities of what the IDF is doing, and not only the killing and all that, but the mentality, the mockery of the people they're killing. And it's just, it's disgusting. A lot of people around the world, they're like, what is going on here? How are we allying with this? How are we allowing our taxpayers' money to pay for this? How are we electing politicians in office that are okay with this? And yeah, it's terrible. It's satanic. There's no other word to describe it.
Isabel said, I'm thinking out loud here. I agree something is up with that wall. What is that wall really? Because Jesus said not one stone would be left on another. I understand what let us it is.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so Jesus said not one stone should be standing upon another. Some believe that that happened in AD 70, that, you know, when the Jews rejected Christ, the Christians were told to get out of Jerusalem. When you see armies compassing, the Roman armies, and then the Christians got out, and I think it was might have been on the Feast of Tabernacles or Passover, where many Jews from all over were in that in the city of Jerusalem, and they were utterly decimated by the Romans as a prophetic judgment pronounced by Jesus when he was here before he was crucified, that that would happen. But they believe that might be Josephus. I can't remember. Some historians say that not one stone was left upon another. And others say, well, there was one wall of the temple still stood. And others say that that wall is remnants of some Roman wall of some building. And I can't remember exactly what it was. So those are different options. I don't know the answer to that. I'm just presenting what I do know thus far.
Yeah.
Either way, that when Jesus said not one stone would be standing upon another, if you're talking about building a third temple or this isn't in Jesus's mind. He's not like for this, okay? He's not for rebuilding a third temple. He's not for going to the Wailing Wall. He's like, after he died and resurrected, he is the temple. That's what he is, right?
Yeah.
And so to go there and wail at the Wailing Wall is to literally deny that Jesus rose again.
She said that would make more sense that it was Roman remains.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense to me. It makes sense to me. But some people believe that the Romans, if that is the Western wall of the temple, that the Romans fulfilled it almost, but then Jesus will complete the fulfillment of the destruction when he returns, and there will be not one stone standing upon another. So just a couple of options to think about. Yes.
Why did Trump even want to build the ballroom?
Why did Trump want to build the ballroom? That's a good question. I don't know. He likes a lot. He likes to build things, right? He likes big buildings. He likes his name on buildings. And so that could just be one reason, right? He says it's for so they can have a secure place where they can have these important meetings that they're supposed to have. But do they need, they already have other rooms that are less extravagant, if you would, where they can get what they need done. I believe, and it's possible that people are telling him, have planted this seed in his ear, that we should get a ballroom built. Now, I'm of the opinion that if America didn't have a ballroom since its founding, 250 years, right? 1776. If it didn't have a ballroom since its founding, maybe there was a good reason for it. Maybe our founders thought, well, ballroom could be used as a dangerous political tool for the elite. And it could start creating two classes, a ruling class of the elite who celebrate in luxury and, you know, they dine in luxury and all that, while the common people are out here, the peasants. And so I don't think America's founders wanted to create this palace-like atmosphere in the White House. Mm-hmm. I think the White House was supposed to just be a simple governing, a simple building where our leaders govern the nation, not all this other stuff. And it is striking to me that all of this stuff is coming up. I mean, when I'm reading the book of Esther, it's like, I'm like reading what's going on in the news. I'm reading like what's going on. It's like we're reliving the days of Esther and Mordecai, if you understand the parable of this book. It seems to make a lot of sense. And any other questions or comments?
So why did all these people hate, not like Haman?
Well, because number one, we must understand that Haman was not a real character, real historical figure. He was created by the writers of the book of Esther, because even the rabbis themselves acknowledge that the book of Esther not only came from Babylonian mythology, it was basically this Babylonian religion and mythology that was rewritten as a Jewish story. Okay, but your question was what again?
Why they hate Haman?
Okay, so Haman, I was laying the groundwork that Haman was a fictional character. I think Haman was a manufactured anti-Semite. In other words, they had to create this guy that supposedly hated all the Jews so that they could now become the victims of hate. And once they're the victims of hate and discrimination and plots against them, then they can gain sympathy. Okay, they can gain the sympathy of all the people to sympathize with them and to let them do what they want to their enemies.
So like when they wrote, the book, is what he's saying is they purposely made a character Haman to not like the Jews so they could prove their.
Oh, yep. Yeah, put the microphone. Yeah, you're right. Good summary. Did that answer your question? Okay. Do we have anything else? Online, in person? Okay, well, we want to thank everybody for joining us. We'll see you Thursday at 9 a.m. Central Time, YouTube Live, for our final study in this book of Esther. And then we move on to maybe one of the Gospels. We'll see. I was kind of toying around the book of John. We'll see where we go. God bless you. Stay in His Word every single day so that you can be a Christian overcomer.
Great sign burning in the sky, woman crying, crowned with light. Dragon waiting at her feet, teeth like night, heart for a spite. Child is carried to a throne, war breaks out above this world. Earth opens like a shield.